It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Good afternoon. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer today. We've analyzed and talked at length about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the controversial Hobby Lobby case. Of course, this is the decision that asked whether family-owned businesses that offer employees health insurance must include contraception in their plans if they object to it in some form or another. In a 5-4 decision on the last day of June, the High Court sided with the companies. Now, we're hearing a lot about that specific case. In fact, on Morning Edition this morning, there was even a piece about how the decision will help Republicans and Democrats in the midterm election. But so much more happened this session. And while the High Court did agree unanimously on 2/3 of the cases, that's something that hasn't happened for decades, the deep divisions in the conservative majority court are really what stuck out. With me to discuss the session are a couple of guests that are no strangers to River on discussions surrounding the courts. In our Iowa City studio, Todd Pettis, who's the Associate Dean for Faculty and H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, welcome back to River to River.
Hi, Clay. Thanks for having me.
And also with me here in our Des Moines studio, Ryan Copemans, a litigator with Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks, Clay. Happy to be here.
So, Todd, let's start with the town of Greece versus Galloway. We'll just jump right into it. This is that decision that had to do with prayer before town meetings. It was a 5-4 split decision that says this doesn't violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. What's the takeaway from this case?
Right. Well, just to set the stage a bit, the starting point that all nine justices agreed on here was a 1983 ruling called Marsh versus Chambers concerning a practice in Nebraska. And as I say, all nine justices agreed that this is where we should start to think about this case. And Marsh was a very simple case. The Nebraska legislature, as a number of legislatures do, began each of its legislative days with a prayer from a state-paid chaplain. And it was challenged then that that was a violation of the Establishment Clause, which, of course, says that government can't establish a religion. And the Supreme Court in that 1983 case rejected that challenge and upheld the prayer practice, largely on a history-driven kind of analysis. It said the practice of beginning legislative sessions or having governmental officials pray goes back to colonial days. They cited numerous times where it happened in their first Congresses and has continued for decades and indeed centuries since. And so the question in the Town of Greece case decided this last term was, is what Town of Greece doing basically the same as what the court has already said is okay, or was it different? And what Town of Greece was doing, it begins each of its monthly meetings with a prayer. The prayers are given by citizen volunteers. I think anyone who wants to sign up for a turn giving the prayer can get on the list and they'll cycle through. But over the nearly decade-long period that was at issue here, almost all of the prayers were given by Christians. And a number of the prayers were what we would say very sectarian in content, where the prayer giver would say things like, we pray in Jesus' name, or we thank God for the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross or the resurrection, things of that nature. And some citizens said, well, that makes it different than what was happening in the Marsh case. And the other thing they pointed to that Town of Greece was doing is that the prayer givers in Town of Greece would stand at the front of the room with their backs to the town council members facing the citizens who were there in attendance, and many of those in attendance were there to do business. They were either there to get an award or to testify about something, and that wasn't the case in Marsh, where really the only people in the room for the most part were state legislators, and the prayers were given ostensibly to the legislators. So the big question was, is this basically a practice that the court has already approved, or is it not? And the court ruled 5-4 that this was indeed covered by Marsh and permissible.
So was that a surprise then that they ruled the way that they did?
No, I don't think so. The Establishment Clause, for people who follow the Constitution, is a famously kind of chaotic part of the court's jurisprudence right now. The justices have really struggled for a long time to come to an agreement on exactly what the test should be when a given practice is challenged. And in the meantime, while there's all these arguments about doctrine, there's a lot of weight that's being placed on history. And in this case, the court, with Justice Kennedy writing for the majority, returned to history and said, if a practice is basically historical and has very deep historical roots, that's probably enough to say that it's not a violation of the Establishment Clause. And so they pointed out, they dug up some prayers that were given in the first Congress and around that time during the founding era, where people made reference to Jesus or otherwise gave prayers that were sectarian in content. So it was not a surprise to see five justices, the five conservative justices in particular, coalescing around that assessment of history and saying that this was permissible.
Taking a look at it big picture, how often do justices look to history for guidance on a decision?
Well, it depends on the area of law. I would say that history always matters. It's a question of how much it matters. And so for the Eighth Amendment, for example, bars cruel and unusual punishment. And there are a number of justices who place very heavy weight there on whether a given practice is cruel and unusual by asking simply, is this a practice that we regard ourselves as a civilized people? Have we engaged in this practice now for a long time, particularly from the founding era? If so, that weighs heavily in favor of saying that it's okay. You know, and one of the issues here, kind of in the background, but a very important issue is the proper role of the court. You know, the court consists of, at the federal level, unelected justices, and we can't vote them out of office if we don't like what they're doing. And so for some justices, their kind of institutional self-understanding says that if the people of the country and their elected leaders for decades or indeed centuries have been doing something, we should really think twice and maybe a third time before we suddenly pop up and say, you know what, the Constitution is being violated here.
Let's move on to another case here, Riley versus California. Now, this is where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that unless police have a warrant, they generally cannot search data on a cell phone seized from someone who has been arrested. Ryan, when you unpack this one, what does history tell us about this? Was there much to go by, piggybacking on what we were just talking about?
Well, first, I think it was a surprising decision because it was unanimous. And I think if you step back a little bit, it doesn't seem that way because you think, well, everyone who carries a phone realizes how much is on their phone. And the idea that someone could just search through that phone without a warrant seems rather crazy to us and a little bit scary. But if you go back in history of the court's jurisprudence in the Fourth Amendment area, you would think there very well could be a split in this case. And so the rule that comes out of this case is from actually 1973. And I'll back up one step further. The Fourth Amendment, right, says it prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. So that language is quite broad. What is unreasonable can be left open to broad interpretation, which is why you often see different decisions from the justices, different tests on what unreasonable means. So we go back to 1973, and in 1973, the court said that when police arrest someone, they can search the person, quote, incident to arrest. And if that person has something on them, they can take it out and they can search it. In that case, it was a cigarette packet. And so the police officer took out the pack, realized that there was not cigarettes in there, but there was something in there. He opened it up, he searched it, and found heroin. Now, the court said that was fine to do, and it looked back to their older cases because they had created this rule that said when you arrest someone, you can search the area around the person for two reasons. One, for officer safety, because if there's anything around that the arrestee could use to hurt the officer, that'd be bad. And number two, to prohibit the destruction of evidence. And in this case of the cigarette pack, the court said, well, none of those really were at issue because whatever was in there was so small, there was really no harm to the officer. And they had the pack, so they didn't have to worry about the destruction of evidence. It could have gotten a warrant. But the court generally likes bright line rules. They like officers to be able to understand these things. And so they said, you know, if you arrest someone, you can search whatever is on them. So if you take a mechanical application of that case to this case, cell phones, it seems then it would be okay, right? And so that's why I think some people thought that that there might be a split decision here and that the court might go the government's way in saying search of a cell phone after arrest is okay. And this case actually involved two different defendants, one who had a smartphone like an iPhone and one who had a flip phone, two different cases. And obviously there's differences there between the amount of data that's stored. So some people also thought that the court was maybe going to draw a distinction between a smartphone and a flip phone and the amount of information in there. Court did not. And so in a unanimous decision, with the concurrence by Justice Alito, but a very minor one, the court said, as you said earlier, that you must get a warrant to search the cell phone. And basically what the court said is that technology has changed everything. And they went through, talked about how much information is on the cell phone. The storing of protecting evidence really isn't a problem, all these other issues. But really, again, technology changes everything. And they were unanimous in that.
So is this something then that as technology continues to advance, I mean, this conversation could keep coming up. We don't know what the phones will look like in the future. Maybe they could be a hindrance on an officer that's searching a car.
Well, it's possible, and the Fourth Amendment is always subject to change because it always just fits into this word reasonable. They'll always be dealing with these intangibles, these interests of officer safety, so it could change. But what's important about this decision was that it was unanimous in basically one test. What you often find, what we saw a term ago with GPS tracking, is that the court might agree generally about whether the Fourth Amendment prohibits a search or doesn't, but they disagree on the tests. And so that confuses the law later, it confuses officers, and it takes a lot of other cases to get to the answer. Here, we pretty much have a unanimous decision, and it's a bright line one. You must get a warrant.
Another thing here, all justices likely have cell phones. Is this part of the decision comes from their own personal lives?
I think so. I think a lot of times you can break justices up into kind of law and order justices and more concerned about government overreach. But to a T, all of them are very private people. I think that the job is just it's a monastic life, and so they're private, but also they're used to privacy. You don't see leaks coming out of the Supreme Court, or at least you very rarely do. So again, the fact that their phone could be searched, maybe if they get wrongly arrested, for example, for having expired license or something like that, that they could page through their entire life, I think that really scares them. I think that's one of the reasons why you see the outcome here. And the court is also becoming a little bit more of a libertarian court, I think, when it comes to Fourth Amendment. And we're seeing the conservative wing go that way too.
Kind of touches on another thing here. We've been concerned with privacy and debating the surveillance being used by the NSA. Are there implications here for the surveillance program?
Well, there's certainly broad implications, meaning the technology changes everything. But there are also little nuggets in the opinion. Chief Justice Roberts talks about things that maybe we would call metadata and talks about you can piece together someone's life. So there's issues about whether metadata, whether gathering that is actually a search. And if you read between the lines here, it looks like they may think so.
So if this case had come to the court 8 years ago, it might have come out differently, would you say? But NSA has changed everything.
I think that's right. I think if you would have saw this case come to the court in 2007, which I believe is when the flip phone guy was arrested, that might not have pushed it too hard. And we were also in a time then a little bit closer to 9/11 that national security interest trumps. And that is a factor that is not at play in this case. This is a criminal justice case. And so when you see the NSA issues come up and you see national security come into play, that might change things too.
Todd, do you have anything to add to implications of how this case has played out?
We're going to talk, I think, a little later in the program about fancy ways to pull down television programs on your internet-connected devices. Mm-hmm. And so we may see a theme there in terms of the court responding to technology. But we'll wait till we talk about that.
On another topic here, the Supreme Court unanimously struck down a Massachusetts law that restricted speech outside abortion facilities, a decision that many abortion rights advocates decried as a threat to patient safety at clinics nationwide. Todd, let's unpack this case. How did it play out going into the court?
Okay. There's a 2000, in the year 2000, a Supreme Court ruling in a case called Hill versus Colorado, which kind of gave the thumbs up to what we call floating buffer zones outside healthcare clinics that provide abortions. And what Colorado had done, again, we're talking about a Massachusetts case, but these cases are never decided in a vacuum. There's always a legal background. And the most immediately relevant legal background here was this Colorado case. And what Colorado had done was said that within 100 feet of the entrance to an abortion clinic, you cannot get within 8 feet of a person for the purpose of protesting or counseling or giving them literature unless you have that person's consent. So you kind of picture a woman approaching the clinic and its entrance, trying to get in for services. If there are protesters there, they have to stay 8 feet away from her unless they have her consent. And the Supreme Court said that that was fine. And so in that same year, the year 2000, Massachusetts adopted basically the same law. It was a little bit different. For example, I think it was a 6-foot buffer zone, so you couldn't get within 6 feet of a person without her consent. But what Massachusetts then found was that there were many violations of that law. Law enforcement officers took videos and so forth, that large crowds, particularly at the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Boston, large crowds would gather near the entrances. And you could see on video that there would be many occasions where women were trying to get in the clinic and pretty clearly without their consent, people were getting within the 6-foot border. So what Massachusetts did is they passed the law that was before the court just this last term. They passed it in 2007. And what it did is, was establish not a floating buffer zone, but a fixed buffer zone. And it said if you within 35 feet of the entrance or driveway to a clinic, you can't go into that area, period, unless you're just a pedestrian passing through or a clinic employee or volunteer or a law enforcement officer. Anyone else, you have to stay out of the way. And at clinics, then they painted these kind of lines on the ground so everyone could see that within the zone, you just simply cannot stand. Now, the objection that was brought to that law, I mean, some people, you know, when you picture abortion protesters, if you're picturing people holding up, you know, visually disturbing signs, shouting, trying to intimidate, those were not the particular people who brought the challenge to this law. Eleanor McCollin, for example, is in her, I think now in her late 70s. And what she and a few other people said was, we engage in a different kind of abortion protest. We're not out here to yell. We're not out here to intimidate. We want to engage in what we think of as calm, non-confrontational sidewalk counseling, where we will calmly approach a woman, offer to help, offer her literature, but we don't want to be yelling at her because we think that that's counterproductive. And they said this 35-foot buffer zone makes it very difficult for us to engage in the kind of speech that we want to engage in. We have to kind of shout at the woman or holler at her or ask her to come over, and that just gets our relationship with that woman off right on the wrong foot right out of the gate. So that was the legal challenge. The justices, all nine of them, agreed that the Massachusetts law was unconstitutional. That may be worth saying a second time. The court, sure. The court was unanimous in saying that Massachusetts had gone too far, but they were divided 5-4 on the reasons. And for those who remember the healthcare ruling about the individual mandate on insurance, the majority in that case reconstituted itself. In other words, it was the four Democratic appointees to the court plus Chief Justice Roberts. And that group applied a test that more the other conservatives on the court thought was a little too lenient. And what Chief Justice Roberts's majority said was there are other ways to do what you're trying to do. And what Massachusetts said they were trying to do was just simply avoid the safety concerns that show up, particularly in Boston, when large numbers of people with conflicting views on a hot issue are right shoulder to shoulder in close proximity. So we want to address those safety concerns. We have access concerns. We have congestion concerns, cars trying to get through driveways. Massachusetts said that's really what this law is about. And Chief Justice Roberts and the four Democratic appointees accepted that explanation, but said, nevertheless, there's other ways you can achieve that end. For example, it appears that the evidence in the record at least suggested that the only Massachusetts clinic where this was a perpetual problem was the Boston clinic, particularly on Saturday mornings. And so the court said you could have a heavier law enforcement presence at that particular clinic. You could rely on laws that were on the books that make it a crime to ban to obstruct someone's effort to enter a clinic. You could rely on those laws and bring out additional law enforcement officers to enforce those laws during the particularly heavy protest times.
Now, how could this ruling be applied in the future, given that this is the first abortion case that we've seen in a while?
It is the first we've seen in a while. You know, the as most people probably know, the court has almost total control over deciding which cases it's going to hear. There are a few small categories of cases where the court is required to hear appeals. But otherwise, they get to choose which cases, which legal issues they're going to take on. And they have kind of taken a break from the abortion issue for a bit. The so-called partial birth abortion was probably the most recent heavily litigated issue at the Supreme Court, and the court came down with a couple of important rulings on that issue. You know, whether this signals that the court is re-entering this terrain, I don't know. If I had to predict what the next abortion-related issue is going to be, I'd say it's one of two things. One is going to be the fact that a lot of states are pushing earlier and earlier into pregnancy the date after which it is illegal to obtain an abortion. That issue surely is going to get to the Supreme Court. And the other issue goes back to the Hill versus Colorado decision, this notion of floating buffer zones. That ruling, which upheld the idea of a floating buffer zone, is controversial in legal circles. In fact, Justice Scalia, writing for four dissenters in this case, wanted to take this opportunity to overrule that precedent and say that that case was wrongly decided.
So before we go to a break, I want to ask both of you, Todd, we'll start with you. How would you characterize this session before we get into some of these other cases we're going to talk about?
Well, this case illustrates, I won't say a new phenomenon, but it's kind of striking that it came up several times where the justices all agree on the outcome but disagree very heatedly on the reasons. If you were to, you know, all these decisions are available on the Supreme Court's website. So the abortion case, for example, is McCullen versus McCullen, MCC, McCullen versus Coakley. So people who are interested can go to the website and pull it up. If you were to read Justice Scalia's dissent in that case, it's an outraged dissent. He's furious. He opens up by saying that the majority is continuing the long practice of giving pro-abortion forces basically a pass when it comes to trying to squelch out the other side. It's a very angry opinion, but it's concurrent. He agrees that the majority got to the right conclusion. We're going to talk about another case here, I think, a little bit later in the show, where it's the same thing. All nine agree on the bottom line, but now they disagree on the reasons. And it's interesting to see the justices, even though they agree about who the right winner and the right loser is, all nine of them agree. The reasoning can provoke the same kind of heated passions and sharply written opinions as ones where they disagree.
And we'll get the same question posed to Ryan when we come back from the break. We're talking about this most recent Supreme Court session with Todd Pettis with the University of Iowa Law Center and Ryan Kopmans, a litigator with Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. We've got more of these decisions to discuss, including that one on presidential recess appointments. That's all coming up. Stay with us. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Good afternoon. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're discussing the most recent U.S. Supreme Court session. So much more happened this session besides the controversial Hobby Lobby decision. While the High Court did agree unanimously on two-thirds of the cases, something that hasn't happened for decades, the deep divisions in the conservative majority court are really what stuck out. Now, do you have questions about the implications of the Supreme Court decisions or the legal questions they dealt with this session? Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Back with me for the second half in our Iowa City studio, Todd Pettis, who's the Associate Dean for Faculty and H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. And with me here in our Des Moines studio, Ryan Kopmans, a litigator with Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. So before we took the break, Ryan, we were talking about summarizing this whole session a little bit. What do you take away from all of the decisions that came out in this most recent U.S. Supreme Court session?
Well, besides the unanimity point, which Todd raised, I think Roberts' minimalism, or maybe some people might call it incrementalism, continues to reign. And what that means essentially is that instead of issuing very broad rulings, Roberts will find the most narrow ground to decide a decision, and that has two effects. One, it kind of the incremental point that it kind of warms the public up to the fact that they may be overruling something or they're going this way. And number two, it does garner more votes, because if you're not issuing a broad ruling, you can get more people to agree. So there is the kind of faux unanimity that Todd talked about, where they're sharply disagreeing about the law while coming to the same general conclusion. But there is also some very real unanimity, and a lot of that was due to Roberts, I think.
So maybe a good segue here to a decision that's Harris v. Quinn. Now, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court signaled its distaste for state laws requiring public sector workers to pay union dues, but they pretty much stopped short of sweeping them away, handing organized labor a partial victory in this contentious case. Let's break this one open. What led up to this?
Yeah, this is definitely one of those incremental cases, I think, or right. Minimalist cases. So in 1977, the Supreme Court ruled that when a collective bargaining unit votes to unionize, those employees who do not join the union can still be forced to pay a fee. And that fee is broken up into two parts. Well, one, the union dues are part costs that are associated with collective bargaining and part political process. That was the rationale. And the ruling was that the unions could force non-union members to pay the cost of the collective bargaining, but not the political activity. And the reason for that, the court said, was kind of twofold. Number one, it creates what they call labor peace. So you won't have these warring union factions in the workforce, and you won't have them giving different demands to the government. And then number two is what's called the free rider problem, which is, you know, associated when anyone gets a benefit for which they do not pay. So the fear is that, well, all these employees are getting the benefit of the wage increases, of the better working conditions, but they're not paying union dues. So moving forward, two terms ago, Justice Alito, in a case kind of about the breakdown of political activity funds and the collective bargaining costs, it had to do with that. But he signaled basically, and other members of the court joined him, five other members, that this 1977 decision called the Bood was built on sand, that it was just wrong. And he basically invited an attack on that decision to overrule it. And that's what people thought was going to happen in this case, Harris versus Quinn. It had been filed in 2010, and the issue was that Illinois took what are these home health care workers who are actually the employees, essentially, of the people they take care of. But they are paid by Medicaid, so through the state, which is federally subsidized. But Illinois said, for purposes of collective bargaining, you guys are going to be a union, and then also will come into play. People who do not want to join the union still have to pay fees. A few home health care workers challenged that statute, and people thought that maybe this was going to be the time where Alito got his way, and it would be the end of public unions as we know it. That was the cry. It turned out not to be that way. It turned out the court in the 5-4 general conservative liberal split just said they are not going to apply Abood any further, and they're not going to apply it in this case because these are to these, quote, quasi-public employees, because they really aren't public employees, even though they're paid out of public funds. But most of the opinion actually goes after Abood and talks about how the justifications for taking away these members' free speech, free association rights, which is that's what this is all mm-hmm. about, they really aren't there. And so Alito still signaled that he wanted to overrule Abood, but the court didn't do it. And we don't know why. Maybe it was Roberts' vote that they couldn't get. Maybe it was Scalia who something may not do it because of stare decisis reasons.
Todd, anything to add on the Harris v. Quinn decision?
Well, just to say that Ryan's exactly right. The big question here is the fate of Abood, which is ABOOD, if someone wants to Google it or something. But the fate of that precedent is very much in doubt. In fact, as Ryan said, not only did Justice Alito, for a lot of his majority opinion, expound on what he takes to be the reasons why Abood should be ditched or was wrongly decided, the dissent picked up that cue, and the dissent spent some pages saying as strongly as they could that precedent has got to stay. And there's a line in there saying something like, our precedent about precedent, which is to say our cases that talk about when we should honor previous decisions. So our precedent about precedent makes it impossible for the court to overrule Abood. So both the majority and the dissent clearly laying down battle lines that will be approached yet again here in another term or two, I would imagine.
Ryan, you have something to add to that?
Yeah, there's an interesting little Iowa hook here. Attorney General Tom Miller, some people don't know that the Attorney General can file what's called amicus briefs on behalf of the state. He can represent the state of Iowa in the Supreme Court. And he joined several other states in telling the court that they should not overrule Abood. And one of the reasons why that's interesting is that Iowa is a right-to-work state. So unless that the law was taken off the books, non-union members can't be forced to pay anyway. So it was interesting that he decided to jump in the fray on this one.
Historically, does Miller do that much?
He does. I think maybe, you know, it ranges from, you know, zero times a term to maybe three or four times a term.
We're setting them up and we're knocking them down. We'll go on to another one, NLRB versus Noel Canning. This has to do with presidential recess appointments. Todd, let's crack this one open.
Okay. Well, anyone who is paying attention in high school or certainly public radio listeners knows our Constitution is a system of checks and balances. You know, one branch of the federal government will be given the power to do something, but then another branch will be given the power to kind of constrain that first branch's authority. And we see that here when it comes to presidential appointments. High-level federal officials, which are basically people who either report directly to the president or whose work really isn't supervised by anybody. So very high-level federal officers. The president chooses them, but then he or she's got to get Senate confirmation. So the president chooses them, but the Senate places a check. So if the Senate thinks that it's a bad choice or for whatever reason, they can refuse to confirm. Now, the folks who set up the Constitution knew that particularly at that time when Congress met for only a small portion of the year and it took great efforts for people from all the different states to travel and come together, there were going to be long periods when the Senate was nowhere to be seen and so not available to approve the president's choices, but yet the president was going to need the services of people to help run the executive branch of the federal government. And that's what the recess appointments clause is for. And it says when vacancies happen during a Senate recess, the president can temporarily appoint someone to hold that position. That's the recess appointments clause, or pretty close paraphrase of it. Now, presidents there's been thousands in our history. There have been thousands of recess appointments, and frequently it's quite obvious that presidents use the recess appointment power not to fill a post during a time when the Senate is nowhere to be seen and so can't help, but rather as a way of trying to avoid Senate obstacles. It's trying to avoid that check that the Senate places on them, and that's pretty clearly what happened here. The National Labor Relations Board, as you said, the name of the case is NLRB versus Noel Canning. Noel Canning is a Pepsi-Cola distributor, and the National Labor Relations Board is a part of the federal government that's very heavily involved in union management disputes. The NLRB consists of five people, and during a short month-long or so Senate break in January of 2012, recognizing that he was not easily going to be able to get Senate confirmation of his choices, President Obama filled three of the five seats. Okay, so those five NLRB members went off and started handling cases. And one of the things that they did is they ordered Noel Canning, this Pepsi-Cola distributor, to do something with respect to a union. There was a labor dispute at the distributor, and the NLRB weighed in and told them what they had to do. And Noel Canning said, well, who is this entity that's speaking to us? There's five people, three of them, it'd be, you know, like Clay and Ryan, okay, the two of you and I show mm-hmm. up and declare ourselves NLRB commissioners. That's essentially what Noel Canning said was happening. These people have no authority. They're just like any other citizen who walks in off the street because they haven't been confirmed by the Senate, and this was an invalid use of the recess appointments power. And so for the first time in our country's history, it's kind of rare that we find this, there's a little piece of the Constitution that the court had never previously interpreted, kind of writing on a blank slate, at least so far as court decisions go. And this is another case where all nine justices agreed that President Obama's appointment of these three NLRB commissioners was invalid, but they disagreed once again, 5-4, on the reasons. Now, what those reasons are, Justice Breyer wrote for the four Democratic appointees plus Justice Kennedy. He set up three questions, and I'll go through them very, very quickly here. He says, to decide this case, we got to create some law here or interpret the Constitution on three points. Number one, do presidents have the power to appoint people to fill vacancies that don't first occur during a break of the Senate, but instead happened sometime long ago in the past but continue to exist during a break. So suppose the Senate is in session, a federal officer dies or retires, so we now have a vacancy. Suppose the president doesn't do anything but just waits until the Senate's on a break. Can he then use his recess appointment power to fill that vacancy? And the court there, the majority, said yes. That would seem to be a win for President Obama in this case. The next question was, does it apply to breaks that happen not between the annual sessions of Congress, but to just temporary little vacations that happen during a given session of Congress? And the majority says yes, it applies then if it's a longish break, at least 3 days or so in length. So it would seem there that President Obama was still in good shape, because that's what had happened here. It was a short little break within an annual session when President Obama named these three commissioners. But then last, the court said, we have to decide what we're going to do with what are called pro forma sessions. And those are sessions when often no business is conducted at all. Most of the senators, if not all of them, are out of town. But the Senate will briefly be called to order in the Senate chamber, maybe only just for a minute or two. And then that little daily activity will be declared ended. Okay, so these pro forma sessions where often no work gets done, but almost kind of in a symbolic way, the Senate opens its doors. And there the court said those pro forma sessions matter. They count. And during this month-long break that was at issue here in January of 2012, the Senate had scheduled every 2 or 3 days or so a very brief pro forma session, quite possibly, one would think, to try to thwart any effort by the president to use his recess appointment power, because the Senate could say, well, we're not really on a break. We're not really on a recess. And a majority of the court said those pro forma sessions count. And the way we do the math, when the day when we look at the day where President Obama named these three people to fill these slots, it was in too close proximity to when the Senate was in session. So the Senate really was not on a recess, and so these appointments were invalid.
Go ahead. Was there more to that?
Well, that's kind of a mouthful. I apologize for the lecture.
No, that's fine. I want to get on to some of the other cases here too, because there's some others I want to tread before we're done today. Another one that has to do with the Fourth Amendment case here, and that involves an anonymous tips of drunk driving. Has a nice little Iowa hook here. Ryan, this is something you can speak to. Talk a little bit about this case.
Yeah, so let me start with the Iowa Supreme Court. Last year, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled 4-3 that an anonymous tip of drunk driving, that police cannot stop a vehicle based solely on an anonymous tip of drunk driving. The U.S. Supreme Court took up the same issue this year, although a little bit different fact pattern, and it came out the opposite way in a 5-4 decision, not your usual conservative liberal split. Scalia actually dissented, a strong dissent, joined by Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Kagan. The only difference between the Iowa case and the U.S. Supreme Court case is that in the Iowa case, the tipster was actually at the bar and said, you know, there are these drunk guys getting in the bar. They're heading into Rat Valley, and you need to stop them. In the California case, it was a caller who had been run off the road by a drunk driver. And you could argue different ways about which case is stronger or not for a police stop. But what Scalia said in his dissent is that, look, just because somebody happens to swerve once and then when the cops follow them, they're not swerving again, doesn't mean that they're drunk. You know, he said, I would guess that the amount of time somebody swerves because of drunk driving is maybe 0.1% of the total. He said, I'm making that up, but no one has any better thing to offer.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in Iowa, because we kind of have two conflicting decisions now. Iowa actually appealed that case to the U.S. Supreme Court because it was based on the Fourth Amendment, but the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the Iowa case.
Another case with some Iowa ties here, Barrage versus the United States. Now, this is a case out of Iowa that's been in the news here.
Yeah, exactly. So argued this term, and the issue there was whether a federal statute that says there is a 20-year mandatory minimum if you distribute a Schedule I or Schedule II drug and that results in the death of someone else. And the question was whether what does result in mean? The government said it's a factor, a substantial factor. I'm still not sure I don't know what that means for sure. The defendant said that, no, it has to be the but-for cause. But for taking this drug, they would not have died. And U.S. Supreme Court unanimously agreed with the defendant, overruling the Eighth Circuit, and the case was argued by Angela Campbell, a young defense attorney here in town. And if you read any national press on the case, by all accounts, she did an exceptional job.
We've got one more case that I want to talk about before we wrap things up, and that's ABC versus Aereo. Now, the Supreme Court ruled that a startup internet company has to pay broadcasters when it takes television programs from the airwaves and then allows subscribers to watch them on, we're back to smartphones, and other portable devices. Todd, what's interesting about this case here?
Well, the case could be as complicated as we want to make it, but in a nutshell, remember the days of the VCR when you could buy one of these magical boxes and plug it in, and voila, you can record TV programs and watch them whenever you want. It's this incredible revolution in our entertainment lives. Well, in a 1984 case called Sony, it's often called the Sony Betamax case, the court said that was not a copyright infringement. If you want to record a TV program on a VCR at home, that's what we call fair use. And the people like Sony who sell the VCRs, they're not contributing to any wrongdoing because no one's committing any wrongdoing. You can watch in private, in this kind of in-home, non-commercial way, your own recorded TV programs. And so Aereo, A-E-R-E-O, Aereo, what they did is they said, you know, we're going to do some technological updates in the land of the internet, but we're basically going to try, we think, to reproduce that system. And so you can basically rent from them each month one tiny little dime-sized antenna, which is off in a warehouse somewhere, and that antenna, which will be assigned just to you, will pull down the broadcast signal at your request for a broadcast TV program. We'll save it in a little computer file dedicated just to you, and you can watch it whenever you want, including only a few second delay when the actual broadcast is happening over the airs. So, you know, your favorite show, this is ABC versus Aereo, so we'll take ABC. Your favorite show starts at 8 o'clock Monday night. You can go on Aereo with your internet-connected device. You don't have to be in your TV. You don't even have to be home. You just click into your Aereo account, and starting just a few minutes after 8 o'clock, they'll start streaming the program to you. And for complicated legal reasons that I suspect we don't have time to get into, the court said by a 6-3 vote that this was a copyright violation. And so Aereo, I haven't checked their website recently. I did a couple days after the decision, waiting to see how they're going to respond. But as things stand now, among your many entertainment options, Aereo has a cloud over their heads because of this ruling having been found to be violating the copyright laws.
But what does this mean for ever-changing technology then?
Well, a lot of the press coverage now they've shifted their attention to the next Aereos. You know, a lot of startups trying to look for ways to make entertainment more convenient, trying to make it available to you on tablets and smartphones and so forth. I don't think there's any question at all that the broadcasters are still in some pretty serious trouble. In terms of trying to fend off this competition, this is one case, one particular form of technology, and the court drew some analogies between Aereo's technology and something called community antenna TV that the court had addressed in the late 60s and 70s, and they drew some comparisons there. So this particular technology at this time under this form of legislation, not okay. Congress could act at any time and bring the Aereos back into existence and commercial viability. And there's other forms of technology that maybe aren't going to quite cross that line that the court will give the thumbs up to. And there's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital being put into the various competitors trying to see who's going to be next that's really going to give broadcast TV a run for their money.
Now, quickly, lots of unanimous decisions, but were the conservative justices really unanimous in their reading of the law in this session here?
Ryan or
Todd, I think, yeah.
Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts now, it used to be we talked about the Kennedy Court. Even when Chief Justice Roberts was ostensibly gave the name to the court because he's the Chief Justice, one of the big weekly magazines ran a cover saying the Kennedy Court. It's clear that Chief Justice Roberts is very much in play just as Justice Kennedy is, for being the swing vote for maybe going with the Democratic appointees sometimes to give us some majorities we might not expect.
All right. Thanks so much to my guests, Todd Pettis, who's the Associate Dean for Faculty, and H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in the Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law, and Ryan Copemans, a litigator with Nye Master Good in Des Moines. Thanks so much, both of you, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.